As humans, we're naturally driven by the search for better. But when it comes to hiring, the best way to search for a candidate isn't to search at all. Don't search, match with Indeed. When I was looking to hire someone, it was so slow and overwhelming. I wish I had used Indeed. If you need to hire, you need Indeed. Indeed is your matching and hiring platform, with over 350 million global monthly visitors according to Indeed data, and a matching engine that helps you find quality candidates fast. Ditch the busy work. Use Indeed for scheduling, screening, and messaging so you can connect with candidates faster. And Indeed doesn't just help you hire faster. 93% of employers agree Indeed delivers the highest quality matches compared to other job sites, according to a recent Indeed survey. And listeners of this show will get a $75 sponsored job credit to get your jobs more visibility at Indeed.com/podcast. That's Indeed.com/podcast. Terms and conditions apply.
Hey there! Did you know Kroger always gives you savings and rewards on top of our lower-than-low prices? And when you download the Kroger app, you'll enjoy over $500 in savings every week with digital coupons. And don't forget fuel points to help you save up to $1 per gallon at the pump. Want to save even more? With a Boost membership, you'll get double fuel points and free delivery. So shop and save big at Kroger today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Savings may vary by state. Restrictions apply. See site for details.
You know, there's a quote in this book that would be very appropriate. This is written by Spock himself, and it's a memoir of the challenges that he faced when he was one of the first Vulcan cadets in Starfleet. Exhilaration enhances the absorption of knowledge. In other words, live a little.
Welcome, everyone, to another exciting episode of the Positively Trek Book Club. I'm always so excited when we do these with a new book because it usually means we get to speak to an author. But I can't host these episodes alone. And with me, also equally excitingly, is Jesse Earle. Jesse, back again for another book club.
Hell yeah, I'm glad to be there. You can definitely host these alone. I'm just the weird dork that's like, yeah, I loved it.
Oh no.
But
no.
I'm glad to be here and help. But you are definitely awesome enough to host on your own. I want you to.
Authors really like it if there's somebody there just shouting, I loved it.
Yeah. No, I'm here to be that person. I mean, at this point, Una, I feel bad because every time I go out drunk with my friends here in Seattle, we get drunk. We end up just talking about your books. and then I tweet at you that we're doing that.
Well, the only complaint is that A, I'm not there, and B, you're not recording it, sending it to me. So get on top of that, please.
I will. Next time I will. There's been many a conversation about your books had in Seattle bars across the area.
Oh, bless you. I really like that. If I feel my neck burning, I'll know I'm being talked about.
Excellent. Well, as I'm sure everyone has figured out, that other voice you just heard is the author of the novel we'll be talking about, Una McCormick. Her latest book, Star Trek Picard, Second Self, is the subject of this show. So, Una, welcome back to Positively Trek. We're so thrilled to have you here.
My absolute pleasure. Always very, very happy to be here. Thanks for asking me.
Of course. Absolutely. Before we get into the book, there's a question that I'm sure is on a lot of Star Trek fans' minds right now, especially, of course, fans of the novels. And that's kind of the fact that it's been a little quiet on the Star Trek literature front lately. And this novel kind of marks a break in that long drought of Star Trek novels. And we've heard a few things from some authors as to why that's been. And I was just wondering if you had any insights into kind of the state of Star Trek publishing right now and what we might expect in the future.
So this book was due out in May, as I'm sure you know. And then I think that publishing, like everything else, has been badly hit by COVID. And this got pushed till September, which obviously was a disappointment for me because it was meant to come out alongside season two of Picard, which is what it sort of bridges to. I'm not sure what that was. This was happening with a lot of my books last year, books that I was doing both with Simon and Schuster and then Trek books with Titan. All sorts of reasons that it could be down to shortages of paper. It could be down to distribution. You know, if you print abroad and then you can't kind of get the books distributed. I'm not sure what the specific reason was, but the powers that be decided this one had to shift from May to September. So I would just say to people, be patient. You know, publishing has a lot of kind of, you know, it lands on your Kindle maybe, but there are kind of hard copy books, and that involves a big production process. A lot of that is maybe offshore or somewhere else, and books need to get from A to B, and covers need to get printed, and all these things. And I think it's been a bit of a logistical nightmare for folks during COVID. So that's the only insight I have. Otherwise, I don't know. the writers are the last people they say anything to.
Why can't they just replicate these things? Come on, just like one book, Una McCormick, please.
I don't mind, so long as, you know, the pennies come my way. I'll keep on churning them out.
Absolutely. Yeah, well, I just wanted that little bit of logistical stuff out of the way, because I know people will be asking, but sure. Let's get to the meat of this, which is this wonderful novel, which, if I may say at the top of the show, was well worth the wait, even though we had to wait a little longer for it. So
thank you.
Excellent.
Thank you so much. I think it's my best yet, actually. I'm really pleased with it. Yeah, I'm really, really proud of it. And it's been so frustrating having to wait so long. It really has. I just wanted it out when Picard was on. But I'm really glad people are reading it.
In a weird way, it actually, I kind of like it that it's come out after season two, because it's a nice, like, sort of bridging of that era for Raffi. And I think it's really nice to, like, shade that in after the fact. It's kind of a nice, like, good bridge that I actually kind of appreciate reading it now. I wish I didn't have to wait so long since season two.
Yeah,
but I think now it works really well.
I see what you mean, actually, because obviously when you're doing these things, you get kind of advance. I was kind of reading season two scripts in advance, so I was feeding in a lot of what I knew about season two. So ideally, some of those themes, I think if you go back to season two, you'll see that they're in the book quite consciously for lots of reasons, mm-hmm. which we can go into when we set up the spoiler warning.
For sure. Well, that's a perfect time to mention. Yeah. So the first part of this, we'll kind of tread lightly and not do huge spoilers, and I'll give everyone a warning so that, you know, if you're sufficiently intrigued and want to go run off and read the book before you get totally spoiled about everything that happens. And trust me, there's a lot in this book.
There's spoilers.
you don't want to be spoiled for this one, I think.
No. Yeah. It's a real treat to read it and absorb the things that happen as they happen and not have that ruined. So also, I have to say, best Una McCormick novel is a very, very, very high bar. And,
bless you. I knew there was a reason I came on this show.
I loved it.
It's so good.
It. This is like other people treat themselves to a day in the spa. Yeah. The writer's equivalent. So I'll go and talk to those people who are nice to me.
Perfect. Well, you'll find a lot of that here for sure.
I would definitely, I mean, I'll save it for like more thoughts, because I'll give my review at the end. But like, I think this is definitely, if not your best, one of your best. I was really,
absolutely.
I put up my own review on my own channel today, and the title is literally Star Trek Picard Second Self is Beautiful, because I think it's an absolutely beautiful novel.
Thank you so much. It's been a long time in the we can get into this. It's been a long time in the making.
Well, let's talk briefly about the structure of the book, and I'm kind of reminded of something that's said to Sisko in the first episode of Deep Space Nine. It's not linear. The structure is really interesting. We start in the quote-unquote present, so after Capellius, then a section goes to after the Dominion War, kind of that era, and then a middle section that pops back to during the Bajoran occupation before we kind of make our way back up the timeline to catch up with the present eventually again at the end. And I was kind of curious, did that structure of the story kind of always present itself from when you were writing it? Or was that kind of a decision made later in the game as the story was kind of coming together?
That was completely conscious from the start, I think. I knew that there were three timelines And I thought there's only one way to do this, which is to nest it. And then I had all the pleasure of going, hang on a minute, do they know that bit yet? No. Okay, right. So constantly when you're writing like that, I probably wrote the three stories straight and then kind of went, right, chop it there, stick those two in, chop it there, put that one in. But then I had to kind of make sure that I wasn't revealing stuff that you, the reader, would not get to the middle. I guess if there was a model for it, it's the novel Cloud Atlas, I mean, that works as a peak. Yeah, that's kind of the central image of that mountain. Whereas this one, I think more of a
valley.
Digging. Maybe a valley. Yeah, I hadn't thought of that. I was thinking digging a hole, actually. But you're right. Gosh, I am clever.
It's thematic.
It is. Oh, yeah, yeah. It's a valley. Completely valley.
Oh, that's perfect.
I
hadn't thought
of that. I love that. That's great. Yes, it is. It is a valley, isn't it? Yes.
That's books, so excellent.
books do this. They have their own designs. It's like, it's like being in the hands of a prophet. You don't know what they've got lined up for you. So books do the same thing.
No, I do that with videos and things too, where it's just like I film something and then it's like, oh, that's very serendipitous. That matches what I was trying to do. And then people will be like, you're so smart, Jesse. And I'm like, yes.
Absolutely. Sure. Completely conscious. Absolutely on there. Yes, it's a valley. It's shaped like a valley.
That's perfect. I'm always curious. I love that insight into how it was written, because like I think when we read novels, we tend to think, well, you start writing at the beginning and you finish until you write the end. And with a novel structured like this, like my brain had kind of a hard time figuring out like how would you have written this? And that makes perfect sense that you would have kind of segregated the stories and then made it fit that valley model. I love that.
Usually what you do is you kind of you're in three fits and starts. I sense like you write a third and then you kind of go, okay, right, what do I need to do for the next bit? And you kind of go back and then push up to two thirds and then you sort of do the last bit. But I think in this case, because I had those three, also it feels a lot better when you're on a tight deadline to go, yes, I finished that bit, so there you go. But the middle section, the sort of heart of the valley, is stuff that I've had in my brain for, I was thinking back now, almost 20 years. So this story's had a long kind of genesis. That central story is one that I've been mulling over in various ways for a very long time.
I don't want to say for spoilers, but when I read the book and figured out what that was going to be, I'm like, yeah, that makes sense for Una. This But kind of a question on that though too, with like structuring it that way. What you said, it was like the intent from the beginning. What was the hope with like being able to structure it that way with the characters? Because for me reading it, I thought it was just a really cool thing to just see, especially for Raffi specifically, but I think just culturally on the people that you meet there. It's like you meet people after these really horrific events, both personally and culturally and societally, and then you go back and see it actually happen, but then see that that's also layered upon something else that came before, and then go back even further. And I thought that was just so intriguing a setup, and I'm curious like what sort of made you think about that and decide to structure it that way.
Well, partly because of the nature of the story that it is, which we won't get into yet. So the kind of science fiction story that it is, so that kind of playing with linearity and with time obviously presented itself, but also because I think it's I'm always really interested in how and when we meet people in their lives. We've sort of met at this moment in our lives. If you'd met me 30 years ago, I'd be a completely different person. And yet I carry that story with me. You just might not have it from me immediately, but it's part of the texture of the way I speak or the way I interact. Or if you knew something about me from my past, it would explain how I'd reacted in a certain way. And I'm also really interested in the way that people re-narrate themselves and how they sort of weave the stories of their own life and retell, or I either get stuck in loops, that are perhaps not good for them, and how they break out of those cycles. And of course, always behind any story that I write in the Trek universe is this idea of the never-ending sacrifice. There are lots of reasons why I think there was only this way to tell this story. And I think it worked. I think it worked. It wouldn't have worked as a linear narrative.
No, I don't think so at all.
It just wouldn't have worked at all. But it's how we meet people. We come in late to people's lives. You know, we don't get a handy George Eliot style introduction. They just appear, you know, from nowhere with their stories behind them. And you have to reveal and unravel them. That was part of it, I think. And then obviously all the other stuff.
Well, I think a wonderful character to use to explore a lot of those ideas, of course, is Raffi, this wonderfully complicated character we got in Star Trek Picard. And she's kind of at the center of this story at the beginning, kind of wondering what she's going to do with her life now that the events of Picard season one have ended and a lot of questions about her life and things that have affected her life have kind of been realized and she's been vindicated a little bit. But of course, that hasn't made everything in her life perfectly wonderful again. She's still kind of where she was and the person she was. And she has paths before her that she can follow, going back to Starfleet Intelligence or this outlandish suggestion from Picard that she go with him to the academy to teach and this sort of thing. So what was it like kind of taking that character and playing with some of those themes? I feel like she's just got so much baggage is the wrong term because that has a negative connotation, but she has so much to play with her past there.
Yeah, I'd written her a little bit before in The Last Best Hope. So I'd sort of seen her at the top of her game. And we see her on screen sort of at the bottom of that valley, don't we? I'm going to use that metaphor all the way through now. and then I think when they came and asked me the book, they said, we want a Raffi story and this is where it's happening. And I thought, well, that's a really interesting place to have someone that she, like you say, she has been vindicated. She's been completely vindicated. All her mad ideas, you know, and her conspiracy theories turn out to be completely true. But as you say, people, she can't just go back to that life. You know, she's had a drug addiction. She's had a divorce. She's lost contact with her son. She has no contact with her grandchild. And then I started to think, well, you know, these people don't exist in isolation. She will have had a job. She will have had colleagues. Those colleagues were probably friends because of the type of work that she did. There would have been long hours and spending time with each other and being part of a team and a club. And what were the sort of casualties of those relationships? So to try and come back to those, particularly when you've been proven right, yeah, which is the most unforgivable thing that anyone can do. Yeah. We can't have you back, you know, out of pity. We have to have you back and kind of admit that, you know, we were unfair. No, people don't like doing that. So to have her in that position, I thought was really good. And there's a fragility to her as well, I think. Or certainly you should feel this at the start of the book, that picking up those pieces and starting over is really, really brave. You know, it's you're digging deep and you're sort of building a life out of little fragments and things. It's like she's putting together a whole self again. Second self, indeed. So that was how I was thinking. I've got a lot of time for Raffi. She's a great character. I think Picard is awful to her.
Yeah.
That is some of my favorite parts of the book, is just the opening chapters. I mean, the whole book is great, but even that part, because I just think you captured her really well. And some of the moments that I really enjoyed during that were when you really show how she's been treated has affected her. So the point where she goes and talks to Picard and he just seems to be, you know, having her there to just like talk to her and see where she's at and maybe try to convince her to join back up with Starfleet. But then when he sort of comes forward with this mission, she sort of has a bit of a response to that, like, oh, did you just ask me here to use me? And it just touches upon how she's been objectified in a lot of ways and just seen as like a tool to be used by a lot of people. And how she's sort of been dismissed and not seen as like a full person. And I thought that was just, you really, really captured that really strongly in those first few chapters.
And he really leaves her in the lurch, you know, when he quits Starfleet. She, you know, it's and you get this in the show, I think. It, you know, he goes back to this you know, his lovely sort of rural retreat, and still has his reputation, but she's sort of torpedoed. So that's it for Raffi, isn't it? Kind of, it's her reputation, and it costs her everything, really. I thought it would be interesting to play with a more complicated Picard, you know, someone who makes mistakes with people, which I think is there in the show. You know, it's the Picard in particular, the TV show, looks at that side of him, I think. And then I had a lot of innocent fun sort of playing with that relationship and a comparable relationship with another mentor and mentee character duo that appear later in the book. So it was a rich vein to sort of explore. I think Raffi, finds herself used. People see her as a resource, and they rarely see her as a person. And that's very painful to her.
Well, one last little bit before we jump into the spoilers, I think, is I just want to sing the praises of your use of Elnor in this novel. One of my biggest regrets from Picard season 2 is how that character was just kind of shelved for most of the season, and we didn't get a lot of him. And seeing him interact with Raffi and kind of establishing a bit of that relationship that we see the end result of in Picard season 2, as well as, and I'm going to highly intimate this spoiler free, the idea of him interacting with a particular character from Star Trek lore who shows up is just so tantalizing an idea. That I can imagine how giddy you were to write those scenes.
Honestly, the cackling that went on was quite inappropriate. he's an interesting, he doesn't get his due in season 2. I wonder if there were difficulties kind of getting him on set. They were filming under COVID restrictions, weren't they? Because he's not really there for a large chunk of it, is he? So kind of fridged at the start. Yeah. And again, I think he's a character who people see as a resource. You know, he's very striking. He's very imposing. He's got this way of alienating you by telling you what he thinks. But he's not very old, and he's probably quite vulnerable in many ways. And he must feel that he doesn't fit in wherever he goes. He doesn't fit in with the Kowat Malat, but he can't be a Romulan because he's been brought up by them. And then he's kind of stuck in the Federation, but he's a Romulan with a big staff who tells the truth all the time. He's not going to win friends and influence people easily, I think, unless people take the time to get to know him, I guess. Get to know him as he is, yeah. And seeing them, seeing him and Raffi kind of understand each other in that way. And of course, at the back of her mind, she's conscious of this, that she's doing this, but she's being careful about it, is that he's a replacement son, that she's getting to have some kind of relationship, some kind of maternal relationship with a young man. But she's quite careful about that. I think Raffi's quite sensible about that.
It's also interesting having him in this novel. Again, no, not to cast aspersions season 1 or 2 of Picard, but like his character being someone who always tells the truth isn't really, I feel like, fully utilized in either of those seasons, just in a thematic way in my mind. Whereas in this book, it really, again, without getting too spoilery just yet, I think it works really well to just sort of mirror a lot of what this story's about, and sort of like people sort of hiding things from themselves, hiding things from each other, and him just being so vulnerable and honest in that way. And then also him having to kind of like temper himself and like having to like learn how to maneuver in these situations that he is kind of ill-equipped for based on how he was brought up.
How am I, if I am living in this world, how am I going to do this and remain true to what I feel and believe? And can I, is it a thing that I'm able to do? I think he acquits himself pretty well, to be honest. Mm-hmm. Yeah. He's, I think Raffi at one point says, you know, you're probably the only blameless one here.
So. Yeah.
Yep.
Yeah.
Yep. The sad part about doing these spoiler-free bits is like we've so barely scratched the surface of what the story is. So if you're listening and you haven't read this, you honestly have no idea what this story is really about. So we're going to get into spoilers now right after this brief break. And when we come back, we're going to talk all the spoilers about Picard's Second Self with Una McCormick. You have been warned.
As humans, we're naturally driven by the search for better. But when it comes to hiring, the best way to search for a candidate isn't to search at all. Don't search, match with Indeed. When I was looking to hire someone, it was so slow and overwhelming. I wish I had used Indeed. If you need to hire, you need Indeed. Indeed is your matching and hiring platform, with over 350 million global monthly visitors according to Indeed data, and a matching engine that helps you find quality candidates fast. Ditch the busy work. Use Indeed for scheduling, screening, and messaging so you can connect with candidates faster. And Indeed doesn't just help you hire faster. 93% of employers agree Indeed delivers the highest quality matches compared to other job sites, according to a recent Indeed survey. And listeners of this show will get a $75 sponsored job credit to get your jobs more visibility at Indeed.com/podcast. That's Indeed.com/podcast. Terms and conditions apply.
Hey there. Did you know Kroger always gives you savings and rewards on top of our lower than low prices? And when you download the Kroger app, you'll enjoy over $500 in savings every week with digital coupons. And don't forget fuel points to help you save up to $1 per gallon at the pump. Want to save even more? With a Boost membership, you'll get double fuel points and free delivery. So shop and save big at Kroger today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Savings may vary by state. Restrictions apply. See site for details.
This episode of Positively Trek would not be possible without the support of those of you who have gone to patreon.com/positivelytrek and signed up to become a Patreon supporter of the show. Thank you all so very much for your donations. They truly do help bring this show to you each week. Thank you especially to our Constitution class supporters, Joyce Marin, Justin Ozer, Jim Stoffel, Jesse Earle, Dave Garcia, Rick Young, Paul D. Kinnear, and our associate producer for the month of October, Linda B. If you'd like to become a supporter of the show, go to patreon.com/positivelytrek. You can get perks such as early access to episodes, ad-free versions of episodes, exclusive content, shoutouts, associate producer credits, and much more. Once again, that's patreon.com/positivelytrek. Thank you all once again. And now, let's get back to the show. So we have this mission that Picard is kind of cajoling Raffi to go on and, you know, to take Elnor, both ideas that she's kind of pushing back against. But, you know, she does kind of go along with this and takes Elnor. And before that, we kind of talked a little bit about this, but her reconnection with her intelligence buddies at the Romulan desk at Starfleet Intelligence. This scene was like, it felt so weirdly familiar and heartbreaking. Like, I feel like we've all kind of been in those situations where we've left and we've changed and we've come back to the familiar places, and your friends, you know, maybe haven't, they've changed too, but not in the same ways you have. And you're kind of now at odds or at different points in your life. Were there like real life experiences that kind of informed that, or it just felt very universal to me that like we've all had that kind of happen?
Yeah, I think maybe when I left my first job, which is probably my only job, and we've been quite a tight-knit group, partly because our boss was not a very pleasant person, so there was quite a sort of, you know, blitz spirit. And I finally had enough and kind of went and left. And I really miss them. You know, they people you spend all, you know, it's not always the case when you work at a job that, you know, they become your friends. But in this case, there were some very, very good friends. And I think I caught up with them not long after I'd left, maybe a few weeks. It was strange. Yeah. Because they've changed because you left. Yeah. Partly. So you're different and they're different, but they're still the same. But you've made that decision to leave and there is no going back. So a little bit of that, much more poignant in Raffi's case, because, you know, they've ghosted her eventually, because she's constantly getting back in touch with conspiracy theories, and eventually they've stopped returning her calls. So I think it takes a lot of guts for her to go back in there. So Picard doesn't probably realize exactly what he's asking.
That's always Picard.
Well, yeah, yeah, it's fine. Just go back.
Just do that thing. Yeah, it's fine. Don't worry about the emotional weight of that.
Yeah, no, I never worry about the emotional weight of anything. You know? Yeah. So why are you doing it? So yeah, she does it. She goes back in, and you know, she kind of acquits herself, and she learns a few things that maybe she hadn't understood about. Maybe one of them was always jealous of her, of her being the star, and she sort of realizes where the friends are, and carries on with one of those friendships, doesn't she? So one friendship is kind of rekindled. But yeah, she goes back into that office, and the pictures haven't changed, and the people are still the same, but you know, a few more gray hairs and a lot more bitterness. And it's a hard thing she does, but Raffi does it. Raffi's got guts. Yeah,
absolutely. Yeah, I liked that symbolism of the pictures on the wall being the same, and you know, her saying like, oh, you should update that. No, we like it the way it is.
Yeah, that's fine. You might, you imagine if you take it off, there'd be that kind of little rim of gray. Yeah,
absolutely. Yeah,
exactly. And I think I'm thinking of an office. I did some work for a government department once down in London. I think I was thinking of some offices I went in there where I thought those paintings haven't moved in years. Mm. Yeah. And nobody's looked at them. Yeah. They're just there. They're just there. So the wall isn't bare. And nobody is actually looking at them. But if you took it away, everyone would freak out. Yeah. Or if you just moved it sideways, like, I should have done that. I should try that out.
It's like her, she just taps it a little bit. Yeah.
I said that out loud, didn't I? but yeah, if you just sort of tilted it or something like that. Those, and the people are like that too. Yeah. So somebody leaving is a big disruption, and then to waltz back in.
So yeah, this mission, she's being sent basically to this world in Cardassian space that was a focal point of the Dominion War. It had been taken by the Romulans. There's this clash between them that, you know, we'll get to. We visit that era as well. But this is kind of opening a lot of old wounds for Raffi. There's a lot of indications that something horrible happened. We don't know what that is yet, but it's opening a lot of old wounds for her. And she's reconnecting with this old Tal Shiar spy master that she had this acquaintance with and this professional relationship, but also kind of maybe a friendship with, it seems. You know, the lines are blurred there. I thought this character was really interesting, and I like that exploration of some of those relationships that she would have cultivated as an intelligence operative back in the day.
Yeah, because these are people that they're not on your side, but they are on your team, if you see what I mean. Yeah, they're doing the same job as you, but they're at the, I think, is that in this book that, oh yeah, they'd have a Federation desk, wouldn't they? They'd have Federation Affairs.
Yeah.
So he's doing the same thing, but spying on her. Yeah. So he'll be having the same conversations. He's another second self, isn't he, I guess? Now I think of it.
It's totally intentional. Totally intentional. Oh,
what a brilliant book this is. Yeah, so he's doing the same stuff, but of course his loyalty is somewhere else. But then there's the kind of brotherhood of spooks, isn't there? There's the people who are more front line than perhaps their bosses who are making the decisions. So he'll understand Raffi a little bit more because she's closer to where the action is happening. Maybe their bosses, the Picards and their whichever Praetor is making the decisions up the chain, they don't have as much in common with. Yeah. So he's there, and they have these moments of sort of strange, I'll say intimacy for want of a better word, where they're like the only other one that they can confide in. Yeah. You know, I know he understands, even though given half the chance his colleagues are going to be killing me. Yeah. He's the one who perhaps understands the most what the situation is like for me. So I was quite pleased with him. The audiobook, he has an English accent. So you know he's the villain.
Of course. I particularly love one scene, I believe it's with him, if I'm remembering correctly, where we go to, this is skipping a little bit ahead, the Bajoran village that had a genocide happen there. And Raffi's sort of looking around, and she's kind of willfully ignorant of what happened there. And he sort of points out to her, it's like, how can you stand here and not actually see it. And that's because you're sort of being ignorant. And then she sort of realized like, oh yeah, the charring on the buildings, that was a fire that was intentionally lit. And it was just one of those like, oh, you just, the relationship of him like sort of like taking the scales from her eyes sort of thing was really well articulated. And I really liked that sort of like constant poking of each other.
Good, I'm glad about that. And I think you've always got I can't resist sort of always questioning Starfleet and their motivations and their I think, does she get called a hypocrite twice in one day? I think, yeah. First by Romulans, then by Cardassians. So, and you can sort of imagine, you know, Starfleet are always banging on about human and species rights, and you know, and they'll kind of blithely go off and do all kinds of things. So, I think she gets used a bit as a punch bag by a couple of frustrated people, because I don't think Raffi is a hypocrite, actually. I think she absolutely isn't. But yeah, there's a moment where he kind of, you know, come on, Raffi, you're not being honest with yourself here. You know what happened here.
I also love that he says, like, our standard operating procedure for, like, working with Starfleet is to assume you're hypocrites. Like, that's just how, like, that you'll hem and haw about stuff, but then you'll end up not doing it.
Yeah. You'll find a way to kind of fudge it. But yeah. I can't rely on that with you, because you're not. It's really annoying. Yeah, you're going to do something stupid and heroic, aren't you?
Yeah.
And I can't plan for that, because that might work, you know? Yeah.
As a bit of an aside, I recently had a conversation with some people about Star Trek board games and video games where they have the factions like Federation, Klingon, and Romulan, and they always like have, you know, Romulan, their special thing is treachery, blah 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 blah. Now I want to see like a board game that's made by the Romulans. Like, yeah. What would the Federation be? Like, I'm sure it wouldn't be, you know,
hypocrite
peacekeeping and stuff.
Yeah.
Hypocrite. Yeah. Absolutely.
Yes. Always spouting Shakespeare. So I'm watching Rings of Power at the moment. I'm actually really loving it. And I feel like it's a massive piece of anti-Elvish propaganda. It's like, we've heard enough from those guys. Yeah, those guys are clearly awful. Yeah, now you're going to get the dwarves' point of view and the men's point of view. So I quite enjoy doing that with Starfleet.
It's an interesting thing where I think we're at in fiction. So this is getting wider, but it's just like an interesting place I think we're at in fiction, especially with large franchises that we've been like as a culture just inundated with a long time, where it's like, well, we've sort of been presented with this like worldview of like, oh, this authority is great. But then once you start breaking it down and seeing it from different perspectives, when is like, as we are in the real world about a lot of our big authoritarian governments and companies and things like that, we start to question it a little bit more. And so I think that that's like, you see that throughout Star Trek as like, especially early Picard and Discovery was very questioning of the Federation. But now in Lord of the Rings, Star Wars was always kind of that. But even when you look at something like the Jedi, it's being very critical of that. So I think it's just a place where we're at in fiction and also like our cultural view of institutions too.
Yeah, absolutely. Completely agree. And the seeds are there with Star Trek. The seeds obviously are there in Deep Space Nine. I think things like Discovery and particularly Picard push it a lot further, I think. So that's one reason why I think a Picard book that hooks up with DS9 themes and stories was a good way to go.
Absolutely. Well, with that in mind, like,
I am very excited.
I can tell. Let's just blow it wide open here, of course. Raffi is sent to apprehend a Cardassian war criminal.
Who
could it be? Very early on in the book, I'm like, could this be Garrick? Oh, it's Una McCormick. Yeah. Okay.
I was completely until that moment where she's giving the briefing with Rios. I was like, oh, it's gonna be someone random, whatever. And then it's like Garrick's like, oh, I think I literally tweeted at you, Una, where I'm like, of course, you just wanted to write a Garrick novel. That's all it was.
Oh, it was literally that moment. That's really, really funny. Yeah.
That's when I literally tweeted at you.
That's so funny. I'm really interested to know when people kind of go, yeah, of course. I'm glad I got you that far, Jesse.
No, I should have realized it sooner, but I was sort of like, yeah, no, it's a Picard novel. It'll keep us, because more mine was just the cynical thinking of like, oh, they won't let her play with Garrick. She's writing a Picard book. They won't let her have that toy box right now. And they let you, which made me very pleased, but I sort of had that in mind of like maybe the publisher thought rather than the artistic thought. So
I can't tell you how pleased it made me.
Oh, sure. <I bet. laughs>
Let's just do it, we said. Yeah.
Oh, that's awesome. Yeah, I had that initial thought, but I think I was kind of like, it was a possibility, but it wasn't until, yeah, it was confirmed later. I was like, okay, excellent. I'm on board. This is so good. Yeah, Garrick, I mean, I love the way you write this character and just so thrilled to see him in this book. And I think it's really interesting how you use him in this novel, because there's a lot of good that Garrick does, and it's acknowledged, you know, he helps the Federation during the Dominion War, and he does a lot of things that, you know, put good in that column. But there's still a lot that's in the negative column that I think sometimes we as fans tend to say, oh, well, you know, just ignore that, you know. But that's what I love about this, is you fully embrace that and you fully get into that. And I think what we get here is a kind of true restitution for the character, which is, you know, something we never really got in this series. You know, like I say, we got him doing good, but that doesn't necessarily cancel out the bad.
One thing that, like, Steve Shives did a really good analysis on Cardassians and, like, things that he pointed out about, like, how can we redeem characters like Damar or something like that. I think his point that he made, which was really, really interesting, was, like, it's harder to redeem someone like Dukat or Damar, which we don't redeem Dukat, but it's harder to do those characters because we know specifically what they did. Whereas Garrick is a character who it's alluded to that he did terrible things, but we don't specifically know. And so that allows us, the audience, to sort of, like, as Dan, you said, we can be like, oh yeah, it's fine. Like, we don't have to deal with it because we don't have specifics. And in this novel, that's what I really, really appreciated you struggling with, is like, oh no, we're going to see what Garrick did, and it's absolutely horrible. And then trying to draw us out from there, I think, was a really, just in the structure of the novel as a finale, was, I think, really, it's a difficult subject matter to wrestle with, and I applaud you for doing it.
Thank you very much. I think it's, Garrick beguiles us, doesn't he? You know, because he's so charming and he's so funny and all of these things. And we do see him do some pretty bad things on screen. We see him torture Odo. We see him attempt genocide. We see him murder several people in cold blood. And we know he's murdered a few people off screen, Romulan senators and their bodyguards. So there are quite a few things that you kind of sit back and you go, you know, that's got to be the tip of the iceberg, guys. Yeah, you know.
This is when he's tempered.
This is when he's got his career as a tailor and he's not an active member of the Obsidian Order. So
exactly.
Like,
what were you doing in the day job, Garrick? You know, because, you know, it's shocking what he does to Odo. It's genuinely shocking when he tries to eradicate the founders. And we get to the end of his story and this terrible thing happens to Cardassia, and we see he's almost broken at the end of the show. But it really, really mattered to me to kind of go, okay, I'm going to take this seriously. Yeah. Because you've got to take that seriously. Yeah? You try to eradicate a species. You torture someone who's effectively a friend. We know there's casual murder that you do. You know, you kill that Obsidian Order guy in second skin and that kind of thing. Lots of quiet asides where you go, oh, that's a moment of truth. So he, there's one bit, I think when he's down on Bajor, I think the Rugal episode, and he's talking to the woman who runs the orphanage, and she goes, well, I was in the resistance, of course. And he goes, oh, perhaps we did meet. And you go, oh my God.
Yes.
Wow, you cold-blooded, you know. So within all the beguilement and the charm and he's very funny, I thought I've got to really take this seriously and follow where this goes and just see what happens. And this is what happened. So and then you think, well, how do you what is justice here, or how do you deal justly with that? And what I hope is that by the end of the book, people aren't quite sure. Yeah, they don't know whether this is justice or fairness, whether he has or hasn't got away with it. But I hope it makes people think. I guess.
No, I was literally, that was gonna be one of my questions, was like, I struggled with it because I was like, oh, is this sort of letting him off the hook. Because that was honestly, when I was reading it, I was actually a little bit like bothered, because I was like, oh, is this letting him off the hook? Is this saying this is okay? And then I sort of sat back and got to the end of the novel and sort of realized, like, oh, that was the point that you were wrestling with, is like, you're not making a clear definitive statement. It's more just, this is very gray, to use that word. And like, there's no clear answers in something like this. And I really thought that was, again, a really deep and nuanced thought for a Star Trek Picard novel to go for. And I really appreciated it. Yeah.
Thank you very much. I think it's, yeah, you look at, we instinctively, you know, we have a concept or an ideal of justice, like we have a concept or an ideal of utopia. And then actually, when it gets down to the nitty gritty of it, it's very, very hard to find a pure solution. And I think the book is sort of asking that, or those were the questions. I don't want questions answered in a novel. I want sort of questions. I want my mind open to new questions. And I hope that's what this does at the end. It should feel open and that you're not sure.
You just made me think about like the difference in our society, then also Picard and people's reaction and stuff. Cause we are, especially in the United States where I live, the idea of justice is very punitive. Like, we want to punish people. Whereas the Federation's ideal is to be very restorative. Like, we want to restore people. And it was an interesting sort of like seeing that push in like Discovery season 4 with Booker at the end, minor spoiler for season 4 of that show. But at the end of that show, like, he gets Booker does some bad things and he gets a punishment that allows him to sort of like pay his debt to society while also like helping hopefully grow as a person. And I saw a lot of people bucket this, like, he should have been punished more for what he did, because that's our mindset as a society, is wanting to punish. And I was like, no, we should always want to restore. And then I get to this book and it complicates it in the sense that, like, I think the angle that Garrick gets at the end is he gets to have that moment of being restorative. He gets to have that moment of like, he gets to try to work to pay back in a uniquely Star Trekian way, he gets to pay back his debt to society or work to try and make it a little bit better or fight back for that. But then you just sort of think, it's like, but does he deserve to be punished more? Does he deserve that? And so it kind of like, again, it sits in that gray between the desire to punish and desire to restore.
And has he already been punished? You know, what happens when the implant breaks down, or a near decade of exile amongst enemy aliens, or the near destruction of his species and his homeworld and his civilization? Are those the punishments? You know, all of these things, I think. Is the work that he does after that to kind of rebuild, is that a kind of repayment? So all of these I sort of wanted out there, because I don't think there are easy answers to these things. And he's a uniquely complicated character to do. I mean, Ducat, you just string him up. Yeah. So, yes, yeah, even me, anti-death penalty, I hanged him high, you know.
Toss him into the fires of the power.
Exactly. let the prophets have their way. But the prophets have got other plans for Garrick, hilariously. So, but yeah, those are things I really wanted the book to sort of, questions I wanted it to pose, but not necessarily to answer. Because I think people need to make their own decision about that.
Yeah, and I love that we do get the multiple perspectives on that. You know, we have the Bajoran, I can't remember the name of the organization, but the agent who their job is to go and assassinate or take into custody former Cardassian war criminals.
Yeah.
He's satisfied by this. Like, he kind of sees the value of this. And someone like Laris, who is also very personally affected by the actions of Garrick, is ultimately not. She feels that he's gotten away with it, kind of thing. So I do like that we get to see those perspectives play out like that.
Yeah, very much so. Bajoran Mossad, I was calling them. But
That was the shorthand in my head too, for
yeah,
sure.
Yeah, Bajoran Mossad. Komatas, I think they're called.
Yes, so, thank you.
Oh, I was very pleased with that invention. Of course they'd have these guys,
yeah,
wouldn't they?
Yeah,
they
absolutely
would, you know. Oh, yes. Yeah, so stick him in. Yeah. So, and he's been on the spot. I think he's watched this unfold. Whereas Laris, I think, who hasn't watched this all unfold, can take a more kind of abstract view. But both positions are right, I think. Both have got she has a personal stake and he has acquired a personal stake. I don't think there's somebody directly that he knows. But obviously he's Bajoran. He's been deeply harmed by these people. So there's that stake. And I tried to make sure that everyone acknowledged that it was up to the people who had been harmed to kind of have the say of what constituted justice or not. But then, as you say, they don't agree on that. Some do, some don't.
I did appreciate that as well when Rafi says, you know, he's your prisoner. You get to make the choice. You have to make the choice here. I thought that was an important moment and kind of shifted my mindset when I was reading it, because I'm like, oh, the Starfleet officer, they're going to be in charge. Wait, no, of course, that makes the most sense. So
this is Bajoran business. It ends up as a conversation between Toes and Apra, doesn't it? You know, the Bajoran woman at the end. It's for the Bajorans to decide. And they decide. They make their decision on the spot. Yeah.
And I love how even Garak is scared of this choice too. Like he's nervous about it and doesn't, like, it seems like an easy thing for him. It's like, oh, I get to get away, but that's not the case. And he, in a way, like there's a certain penance you're talking about, like, oh, he has to live among enemy aliens. He has to literally live the last parts of his life, like wearing a Bajoran face and being a Bajoran. I think it's just a poetic, I think even he would say a poetic end to his life.
I think the prophets thought through this one.
Yeah.
And stuck with a bunch of kids as well.
Yeah.
It's not even a quiet retirement, you know, it's sort of a bunch of howling kids.
I'm curious your thoughts on this, because I was trying to think of, there's some interesting parallels between the end of Garak's story and the end of Dukat's story, where they both take on Bajoran faces, but for wildly different reasons, obviously. But I thought that was interesting, that Garak is wearing this face to kind of do penance for his life and the things he's done, and Dukat takes on that face to further his exploitation of the Bajorans and that sort of thing. I was just wondering, was any of that on your mind while you wrote that?
Yes, it was. And it's one of those things where I can't remember where it was a conscious. I tend to be quite intuitive in these sorts of choices. And then afterwards I go, oh, right. Yeah, I see why my hindbrain made that choice. Yeah. But I was conscious quite early on that it was a direct parallel, particularly as the prophets both intervene in their ultimate fate. But I think they are more forgiving of Garak, who I don't think has blasphemed so egregiously.
I mean, he didn't literally become a like Jesus figure for the Pare.
Yeah, I think he is more disrespectful and disbelieving. Until he just can't avoid believing in them, and then he sees that he's just been absolutely outmaneuvered by some considerably more powerful beings, who turn out to have a sense of humor. But yeah, I think it was, I knew he would have this Bajoran face. That was very early on, and then I think not long after I went, oh yeah, of course it's because Dukat has one. Obviously he's like he and Dukat have this sort of strange mirroring second self thing going on with each other. So that did obviously have to be there. Dukat's version is always a bit more twisted. I have literally nothing good to say about Dukat. I despise that character so much. A genuine thing. I really, really try always to find the decent bit in a character, but I can't do it with Dukat. Can't.
Well, I think I'm going to have a compliment and then a question real quick for you. But just to jumping off the Dukat thing, I think also it's partially because Dukat never takes responsibility. Like Garak, for all of his faults, he is very keenly aware of what he's done. Even if he doesn't let other people see it or let people into it, I think he's very keenly aware of the weight of it. Whether or not he lets himself emotionally feel it is a different question at times, but he knows it. And I think Dukat just constantly is like, well, it's not my fault, it's other people's fault. And I think that's where part of our willingness to see Garak more complicated eyes is taking responsibility, which I think is a conversation as a culture we have today too. It's like people denying responsibility, saying I'm being canceled or I'm being this or that. It's denying accountability.
And Garrick's like, it's my fault, but try pinning it on me.
Like, it's definitely my fault, but you won't be able to legally say so.
Yeah.
But so a compliment and a question. Compliment is, I really just want to compliment you on the I think the really beautiful sequence when they go into that final bit, when they're all heading in towards the center of the valley, and you get to see the grave that we ultimately learn in a few moments later is Garak's grave. And that, I was just like, that moment sitting with that, where everyone's sort of like, is this, like, this has the name that Garrick kind of made up a second ago on it. So like, did he know this? And then Garrick sort of being confused and like kind of struck by it. And I think realizing slightly before everyone else does in that moment there, where it's like, this is my grave. I thought it was just, it was very beautifully written. The question that I have kind of jumps off of all of this is you worked so hard in a lot of the post-Nemesis books to like do a lot of work with Garrick to build a Cardassian culture post the Dominion War. And you bring some of that in here, but also because of the nature of the fact that we're in a new canon, a lot of things have changed, and the like stuff that's happened to Garrick completely changed. Like, he got to be leader of Cardassia in your other novels, whereas here he got to be like a Federation ambassador, but he's certainly living a much different life. And I'm curious to your feelings as an author, because I really liked that you took on the challenge and did something new instead of redoing the things that you've already done. But I'm curious as the author, what that felt like to sort of think about this character and this setting in a new way than what you've already built.
Yeah, this is a really, really interesting one, because I think I've said before, I kind of had a final book in mind for all that Cardassia canon, book canon, and I didn't get to do it just because of the way things shook out. But it's changed substantially, but quite a bit of what would have gone in there came over to this. Because it was, and I think you can probably see that from, if you go back to sort of Enigma Tales, you can see that, that there's the question hanging over Garrick of, what did you do during the occupation? So that was always the really big question in my mind. That was the thing that needed to be resolved. That would have been resolved completely differently, because there was loads of other stuff that had to be tied in, not least the presence of Julian Bashir on Cardassia Prime and the presence of Parmac and all this kind of stuff. And this is all solved in my head. And then I thought, okay, all right, I've got this chance here to do one part of that story. And probably it's the part that is actually the most important, which is the question of the nature of his guilt and our beguilement in the face of his egregious act. And that's the bit that I'm going to tell in this. And then it was just a case of going, okay, all right, then I just let all that go and I go back and just tell that story. It was quite relaxing in a way. And as I say, I've sort of had this story about what happens at this temple in my mind as a kind of Garrick headcanon from before my first book, from before Stitch in Time, even, so this has sort of been in my mind. And then to go back to that, and then it changed all over again, because of course it had to work with this book. It was like going down back into the valley.
It's almost like you had to make a second self, or like
exactly. Yeah, exactly that. The author was, okay, gotta let go of the kind of the beta canon and just tell this story, tell Garrick's story in the Picard universe. And I really love it. I just think it's amazing to get to tell so many variations of these stories. And the show does it. We've seen loads of different Spocks and loads of different Kirks, and to get to do a completely different Garrick, but one that stood consistently and kind of on his own terms with what we knew in canon and what we know from Picard. To do a Picard Garrick, Star Trek Picard Garrick, and not a DS9 one or a beta canon one, just to kind of go, right, we'll just wipe it clean and see what would be the same and what would change. And this is what came out, which is really lucky. I was really disappointed I didn't get to wrap up that story. And then I thought, no, let's turn this into an opportunity and tell the heart of that story, but in this different context. And I think it, yeah, I'm really lucky that I got to do it. Lots of stuff I didn't get to do. Oh, his final, gets his comeuppance, the Abzenkethi get their comeuppance and this kind of thing. It's all there. There's loads of stuff that I was going to wrap up, but we didn't get to do it. But we got to do this instead. And, I can't complain about that.
One day I'll buy you a drink at a bar and I will get that your version of the story from.
Totally. Yeah. I've got about 30,000 words of it, I think. I've kind of during lockdown, I just wrote it for my own amusement. So there's quite a lot of it. So
Wow. Yeah. Shoot me an invite. I'll be there.
Yeah, I'd be happy to. Yeah, we just couldn't find a way to get it done. I think once Coda was underway, it was going to wrap up, and the ideas I had wouldn't have fitted with Coda. So you got Coda, and you got this. So I think we did okay. Yeah, I think everyone can be happy. Yeah,
best of both worlds, as they say.
Exactly.
I just want to call out a few notable moments for Garrick in this book, and this section is nothing more than me just saying I freaking love your writing. Oh, it's so good. The moment where during the occupation period, and he's undercover as Mass Garrod, this down and out quote unquote loser who's you know been in legal trouble and stuff. The moment where he turns into Garrick when he walks into the office, and this is one time where I had read another page or two, and that's when my brain realized that you'd switched from Garrod to Garrick. And I had to flip back three pages and be like, where? Oh, and the paragraph, it's like Mass Garrod walks into the office. The guy yells at him. He walks over to the computer, says the code. Garrick looks up and is like, oh, that is amazing. I love
Thank
that.
Thank you. And it's a real Easter egg there. Because that's the code he uses in seconds. Yeah, yeah, you got that. Good.
Yeah, as soon as you said black, I was like, oh, black. That's the... Yeah.
The code in second skin. Yeah, yeah. My God, she is that nerdy. Yeah.
That's excellent.
But I knew that somebody reading it would get it. So, I had... And then he's Ethan Garrick from then on until he stops being... on the audiobook, she does it brilliantly. She sort of... And that's partially, you know, an American accent softens the D's slightly. He's Garrod. Yeah, it's closer to Garrick. It just sounds, because, you know, in my English voice, it's Garrick and Garrod. Yeah, no, you see, wouldn't. But she just blurs it beautifully. So it's like she's teasing you, but playing fair. It's really, really good. But I love that moment. Yeah. And the guy's all ready to punch him. And then he's like, sir, yes, sir. What can I do?
That was so good.
Literally not change, you know, you could just shoot him here and nobody would be any the wiser, but you absolutely won't, because you don't know who's behind him. Yeah. Or what rooms he's got bugged, and they're right to be afraid, I think.
Speaking on the, we mentioned the audiobook, but since we spoke before we started recording, but just to mention, what is it, Jennifer Lavoie, I think is how you say your name?
She's January Lavoie.
January Lavoie, excuse me. She's fantastic. Just for listeners, like if you have not listened to the audiobook version, I highly recommend it, because she does such a good job. She does everyone perfectly, but Elnor in particular, I was listening, like she nails his accent so well. Like it's perfect. I was listening like, did they get even Goria in here? Like what? It's so really good.
And I think like I was saying just before, I mean, she has to do about 5 or 6 different voices just for Garrick, the different ages and the different kind of undercover roles that he's doing, and she does them all perfectly, including a scene where he kind of talks to himself, so she does that incredibly. That's just really, really moving, that scene, because of course he ends up talking to himself, because it's
That feels like a Garrick way to go.
It would be, yeah. End up just, that's the only good conversation I've had here. Oh, it was in myself.
that's an interesting point too, because there's a lot of Garrick in this novel. And then by the time you're done the novel, you realize there was more Garrick in the novel than you'd thought.
Then you realized, yeah.
Yeah. And it's rare that I will read a novel a second time very shortly after I've just read it, but I feel like I have to read this again from the beginning with
like,
that in
like
mind.
The prophets, I'm taking the piss out of you pretty much.
what you gotta do is you buy the book version and then give that money to the publisher, and then the audio version, there you go, and get two different experiences.
You know, that's actually a brilliant idea. That might be how I have to experience it a second time.
It's what I did. I literally bought the audiobook, and then I want to support your writing. So I bought the audiobook, and I was like, well, I just need the book version now, because I just need to own this one. So I have the book version as well.
Nice. Well, audiobook works for me as well. I'm, I, you know, oh, I, yeah. Yeah, absolutely. That's fine. You know, But in England, if you borrow it from the library, I get money. So they have this little pot of cash. It's called the public lending rights, and there's a pot of cash. And every time a book is borrowed from the library, you get like a tiny little bit, but they cap it so that Stephen King doesn't get all the money. Yeah.
Yeah.
You're hitting up a level and then you don't get any more if you're Stephen King. Yeah. And every year, and you don't get vast bucks, but every year, particularly if I've had something like a Picard book or a Doctor Who book, I'll get like 150 quid or something. It's just, it kind of arrives and I go, oh, brilliant. That's covered that thing I shouldn't have bought. That's
people's Christmas presents. Perfect.
Yeah, it's an amazing thing. They're public lending rights. Any author publishes in the UK and in Ireland should look into it, because it's just great. And it always arrives in the nick of time. Oh, thank God that's arrived. You know, it's small, but it's just saved my life in some small but specific way. So yeah, audiobooks. Yeah, it's, you know, I'll see something from it, and even library borrowing as well over in Britain.
Well, between the two of us, we've purchased it every way I think we can. So I've got the ebook version here.
Beautiful. Well, that's what we even more do we like to see that. So
I feel like that's the real way to listen to read a Picard or any Star Trek novel is on the Kindle version, because that's just like you're reading it from a pad.
I agree.
But for it really to be like a pad, the other books you're reading are kind of piled up on different Kindles.
Different one for every book. Yeah,
exactly. Didn't quite get there, Lance, did we?
Excellent. Well, I definitely don't want to end this without talking about the interaction between Elnor and Garrick, and Garrick's just complete giddiness at the realization that this kid will not tell a lie.
Tell a lie?
He's like, what's that like?
It's the galaxy brain thing, isn't it? Live like that? Yeah.
He's like, you're just like a little, like so much information that you just gave so freely in that one little sentence.
Exactly. He's the one that they all just tell the truth to. Why didn't I think of this one? It's just incredible. Yeah. And then Elnor, of course, kind of saves the day, doesn't he? He's just there with his staff at the right moment. So I possibly could have had a bit more fun with that, but I thought it was one of those things that could rapidly become self-indulgence. You could have had pages of those two just going off on each other. But I think the sort of suggestion of it, and Raffi kind of, no.
You go over here.
No, absolutely not. Like when your parents go, I don't want you hanging out with XYZ.
Yeah.
Now I want a Garrick Elnor novel. Sadly, it won't ever fit given the timeline, but I would love that.
Or like a Spock versus Q style just conversation. Oh man.
There's got to be a short story in there somewhere, I think. Mm-hmm. But yeah, it's like it's like the magnets that sort of repel.
Well, I even love the moment too when Garrick basically gets Toes to hit him, and you know, he's lying on the ground, he's like, Elnor, you're coming to the trial, I want you there.
the whole truth and nothing but the truth. Exactly. This is brilliant. I can't believe I got this guy. Is just so perfect a witness. Yeah, he's charmed by you. And that's another charm of Garrick, isn't it? I think he's even when he's jaded, he still sort of takes a kind of there's a sort of mischief and delight in what's presented to him, and an eye for how he can turn it into an opportunity as well. And Elnor's a great opportunity. He's also beautiful, which doesn't harm. So
yes, that too.
Speaking of beautiful, I loved Garrick's references to Dr. Bashir, this beautiful doctor that was wonderful. Just that made me a little misty-eyed.
Yeah, the love of his life. Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, whether Julian finds a way to join him, that's one I shall leave for the fan fiction writers.
Go jumps back in time.
Yeah, finds his own orb.
Mm-hmm. Orb of love or something like that.
Yeah.
I do just one other little thing that popped into my mind while I was reading this. When they come across Garrick and they're talking about, you know, the things he's done, and he's talking about the things he did to help the Federation, he even kind of obliquely refers to the Romulans getting into the war and that kind of thing. And I wonder, in this alternate reality where there is a trial that Garrick has put on trial, does all of the things that happened in the Pale Moonlight come out at that trial? And is the Federation, like, if they had brought Garrick to trial, are they really just kind of signing their own death warrant with that?
He's absolutely got his, you know, he's got his hand around their throat, really. There's that they don't want him. Particularly in this book, they don't want him getting anywhere near a microphone. You know, it'll all come out. It'd be an absolute disaster. So the best thing that could possibly happen, as far as the Federation are concerned, is that Garrick disappears completely. And I guess the Cardassians are just clearer that he's an embarrassment. Yeah, it's a kind of relic from the past that they're trying to draw a line under and move on and show that they're changed. And yet you've got this guy still hanging around. The Bajorans want him because, you know, he's a murdering bastard. But the Federation have a real problem here because he's got them by the short and curly, hasn't he? So this is an ideal solution as far as the Federation concerned. Poof, the problem just goes away. And that's his, you know, even when he's got his hands bound, he's got that stored in his back pocket. I can't remember now whether it says in the book whether Raffi knew. I suspect she doesn't. Whether Picard knows, I don't know. And I did sort of toy of sort of bringing that in as a plot strand, and maybe having Laris involved in some way, but I couldn't quite get it to work. I think it was just a kind of plot complication too far, and it was better just left as kind of in the background and making it a much more personal beef that Laris had with him. The details of which are sort of, I'm not entirely sure myself, because she hasn't told me, but it might have been on Romulus. It might have been somewhere else.
Another book?
Yeah, another book, indeed. no more Garrick books.
No, don't say that.
Oh, no.
I'm done now. I'm done. Michael Clark said on Twitter, he got it early, and he said to me, "Oh, that must have been it must have been quite emotional." I was like, yeah, 20 years of my life. I can't see what else I would tell now, but you never know. He's done that before. I feel like he's gone away and then he's jumped up on me. So so who knows?
One last question that I had too, because we focused a lot on Garrick, and I know this will be a harder question to sort of jump off on. Just the question of how that we talked about personal responsibility, but I also really liked how this novel, in going back each time, dealt with how this place that this book mostly takes place on has had these repeated genocides and attempted genocides. Not that I like that's happened, but like how you showcase how these things sort of build up and almost cause each other. These sort of lasting resentments sort of build upon each other, and anger builds upon each other, and how people wish to sort of look away from it, and that allows it to happen again. It's mirrored in Garrick's personal story, but it's also shown culturally, the repeated building upon traumas and the willing denial of things. And I thought that was I was sort of like, I guess there's not much of a question other than a compliment, I guess, but I would love to hear you just talk about that sort of idea of this, like, cultural traumas and personal traumas just building upon each other.
Yeah, I think I'm always very careful not to draw directly from historical examples. I suspect that the histories that I have in mind would be perhaps Northern Ireland, and in this case, I think I have been reading about the massacre in Srebrenica during the Bosnian War. So I think that was preying on my mind as well, which I think you've got other United Nations or NATO peacekeepers there who find themselves in a similar situation, and that obviously is a part of the world where there's, you know, this sort of repeated reprisal and reprisal after reprisal. So I think there are places where there's people can't escape history. I think there's a line at the start of Ulysses. Is it the start of Ulysses? It's one of the Joyce novels. It's either Ulysses or Portrait of the Artist. History is a nightmare from which I'm trying to awaken. And I think that gets into the book somewhere. But you know, this kind of cycle that I'm just trying to get out of and stop it repeating itself. And I think people do act on that, and that it can be tied to specific locations and specific grudges. And then I think, because partly this is a little bit of a ghost story, there's a lot of kind of English Civil War stuff. So a lot of really good ghost stories in English literature kind of centre around the English Civil War and the kind of scars of that and the traumas of that kind of lead to haunting and repression and denial and all these things and unspoken traumas. So I guess these are all floating around. And as I say, I'm extremely careful to not sort of use specific historical examples, but it all feeds into a story that I want to tell. And that's centered on this place, I think. So, but hopefully it drew its own history. But I suspect all of us, wherever we are, you know, I happen to be, have Irish grandparents. I'm sure anybody, or I hope that, you know, wish they experience them, but they can open that book and go, this is a history that I recognize or that I can understand, or that I maybe doesn't form part of my personal history, but I can see that it could form the personal history of other people. So that's sort of where the book came from.
I definitely had in mind, especially the pain of the Starfleet officers who have been ordered to remain neutral while this could potentially happen right in front of them. General Romeo Dallaire of Canada was leader of a UN peacekeeping force in Rwanda in 93 and 94.
Yeah, yeah.
And his book Shake Hands with the Devil is all about just having to be there while this genocide happened around him and being completely powerless to do anything about it. And I definitely was getting those vibes from this and that experience.
That's another good example. Yeah. Sort of, that's sort of simultaneous to the Bosnian War, isn't it? Yeah. You know, oh, be neutral. You can't be, how are you neutral in the face of something like this? Yeah. Horrible, horrible order. And Starfleet are so distant in this, you know, they can't get there. And then there's, you know, sort of plot complications. And I think that, you know, at the kind of, you know, keel hauling at the end, the Admirals kind of go, yeah, well, you know, we can't exactly, we're not going to do anything to you, are we? Because, you know, it turned out, you know, if it had been a disaster, perhaps something else, you know, a different outcome. But everybody sort of turns away from it, which I'm sure would make the Romulans and the Cardassians look typical Starfleet, you know, a bunch of hypocrites.
Yep, standard operating procedure.
Exactly that, yeah.
Well, I feel like I want to take this novel and stand on the rooftops and just yell that it's the definitive Garrick novel, but I don't want to ruin it for people either. So that's my hands are tied there a little bit. But I just want to ask you, Una, is there anything that you wanted to let our listeners know that we haven't talked about with regards to this novel yet?
Oh, I guess you get a little appearance from Inarbrin Tain as well. So yes. if that isn't enough, you get Inarbrin Tain. Being kind of like the anti-Picard. So
I would say mirrors, as you said, mirrors the relationship that Picard has with Raffi.
Yeah. Which is part mentor and part, you know, he and she are part resource, but it's considerably less toxic in the case of Picard and Raffi. But if that's not enough to make you read, the presence of Inarbrin Tain surely will be.
Yeah, and you get to hear the amazing Paul Dooley in your head as you read. So it's so good.
He's great. How many episodes is he in? Is it like four or something?
He's in The Wire, and then
he's in Dyer's Cast and very end of Improbable Cause.
That's right. Yeah. And then he's in the first part of that other one with where they're in
the Dominion internment camp. Yeah.
So it's either he's in four episodes. Can you believe that? It's incredible, isn't it? Yeah. Star Trek's worst dad.
Yeah. Which is saying something.
Yeah. I know. It's kind of like the proud winner of that crown. I'm sure he'd be delighted.
Like Garrick's just like talks to Alexander and just like, look, you think you had it bad, all right? Worf's a great dad compared.
Yeah. Even to Zial, you know.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Yeah.
Well, I think it's pretty obvious. I highly recommend this novel. I think everyone should read it. You know, Picard fans, DS9 fans, all the fans. It's so good. And Garrick is a character I've loved so much. And to see his life extended beyond what we see in the series in your novels, and this one kind of being his swan song, just really will always give this novel a special place in my heart. So thank you so much. And I appreciate the difficulty that you must have had in writing it too. I totally understand. Well, I don't totally understand, but I can certainly appreciate what you had to go through to write it. So thank you so much for your never ending sacrifice.
Take it for the team. Yeah.
Tamir Dan's thoughts. I've said it before, you are easily my favorite Star Trek author. And I say that compared to everyone who has written Star Trek, not just in the books, like all writers of Star Trek, and that's no dispersion on them. There are many fantastic authors, but I love your writing. I love your work. And this is one of my favorites, if not my favorite novel of yours. So yeah, I think you really destroyed it. So thank you so much for this book and thank you so much for your work. So.
Thank you. It's just so, you know, you write a book and you're just by yourself with it. Yeah. And then you kind of, and then it's publication day gets pushed. Oh, God. Me by myself with it for even longer. And then it's finally out there and you think, oh, they're going to hate it. And then just, if people just really get it, it's so gratifying. Really, really grateful. So you just want to be read and understood, really. And you guys have read it and understood it. I'm very, very grateful. So thank you.
Well, if people want to follow what you're currently working on online, is there anywhere that they can do that?
They can find me on Twitter. I'm at Una McCormack. And I have a little newsletter as well, where I sometimes sort of talk about what I'm working on or just what's filling my mind with you know, slightly more consistency than you can get into a tweet. So those are sort of the two main places where you can find me.
Well, thank you so very much for joining us. We truly do appreciate it.
My pleasure.
And Jesse, where can people find you online?
Too many places because I do too many things. You can find me at Jesse Gender on YouTube, where I do video essay stuff. I have Jesse Gender After Dark, where I do news, reviews, and reactions on TV shows and things like that. I just reviewed a certain novel that we've been talking about over there. So you can go check that out. I say terrible things. 1 out of 5 stars. It's
I know. She's a real hack, isn't she? It's like 3 or 4 books a year.
SJW woke nonsense. It's awful. But yeah, I'm there. I have a Patreon. I'm on Nebula and I'm on Twitter. You can find me in all those places. So yeah, that's me.
I'm on Twitter at Kertrats, KERTRATS, youtube.com/KertratsProductions. You can, of course, find the podcast at Positively Trek. Join our Positively Trek discussion group on Facebook. And that's about it. Email us positivelytrek@gmail.com, patreon.com/positivelytrek, all the things. Thank you once again, both of you, for joining this episode of the Positively Trek Book Club. This is such a special episode because it was such a special book. I'm just going to be effusive with my praise about this. So thank you once again. And to everyone else out there listening, thank you for listening. And until next time, stay positive.
Hey there. Did you know Kroger always gives you savings and rewards on top of our lower than low prices? And when you download the Kroger app, you'll enjoy over $500 in savings every week with digital coupons. And don't forget fuel points to help you save up to $1 per gallon at the pump. Want to save even more? With a Boost membership, you'll get double fuel points and free delivery. So shop and save big at Kroger today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Savings may vary by state. Restrictions apply. See site for details.